10. Then came 1923. That extraordinary year is probably what has marked today's Germans with those characteristics that are so strange and incomprehensible in the eyes of the world, and so different from what used to be thought of as the German character. The uncurbed, cynical imagination, the nihilistic pleasure in the impossible for its own sake, and the energy that has become an end in itself. In that year, an entire generation of Germans had a spiritual organ removed, the organ that gives men steadfastness and balance, but also a certain inertia and stolidity. It may variously appear as conscience, reason, experience, respect for the law, morality, or the fear of God. A whole generation learned then, or thought it learned, to do without such ballast. The preceding years served as a novitiate in nihilism, but in 1923 its high priests were ordained. No other nation has experienced anything comparable to the events of 1923 in Germany. All nations went through the Great War, and most of them have also experienced revolutions, social crises, strikes, redistribution of wealth and currency devaluation. None but Germany has undergone the fantastic, grotesque extreme of all these together. None has experienced the gigantic carnival dance of death, the unending bloody saturnalia in which not only money, but all standards lost their value. The year 1923 prepared Germany not specifically for Nazism, but for any fantastic adventure. The psychological and political roots of Nazism reach further back, as we have seen, but that year gave birth to its lunatic aspects, the cool madness, the arrogant, unscrupulous, blind resolve to achieve the impossible, the principle that might is right and impossible is not in our vocabulary. Nations, it seems, cannot go through such experiences without spiritual damage. I shudder to think that after the next war, the whole of Europe will probably experience a magnified 1923. That is, unless very wise men make the peace. The year began with an atmosphere of patriotic fervour. It was almost a repeat of 1914. The French, under Poincaré, occupied the Ruhr. The government announced passive resistance, and among the German masses the feeling of national humiliation and danger, probably more genuine and more serious than in 1914, once more overcame their weariness and disappointment. They rose up, and with strenuous emotion declared their readiness. But for what? For sacrifice? For struggle? It was not clear. Nothing was demanded of them. The Ruhr War was not a war. No one was called up. There were no bulletins. With no outlet, the fury subsided, but for days crowds solemnly intoned the Rütli Oath from Wilhelm Tell, a play by Friedrich Schiller about the founding of Switzerland by William Tell. We shall be a united nation of brothers. Gradually the gesture became slightly ridiculous and absurd, because it was being made in such a void. Outside the Ruhr, nothing at all happened. In the Ruhr itself, there was a sort of subsidized strike. Not only were the workers paid, but also the manufacturers, and these only too well, as it soon became widely known. Was this patriotism, or compensation for lost profit? Some months later, the Ruhr War, which had begun so well with the Rütli Oath, began to smell unmistakably of corruption. Soon the public lost all interest. Far stranger things were happening nearer home. That year, newspaper readers could again play a variation of the exciting numbers game they had enjoyed during the war, when counts of prisoners and size of booty had dominated the headlines. This time the figures did not refer to military events, in spite of the warlike way the year had begun, but to an otherwise quite uninteresting, everyday item in the financial pages, the exchange rate of the dollar. The fluctuation of the dollar was the barometer by which, with a mixture of anxiety and excitement, we measured the fall of the mark. The higher the dollar went, the more extravagant became our flights into the realms of fancy. There was nothing really new in the devaluation of the mark. Even in 1920, the first cigarette I had secretly smoked had already cost 50 pfennigs. By the end of 1922, prices had gradually risen to between 10 and 100 times the pre-war peacetime level, and the dollar stood at about 500 marks. This, however, had happened gradually. Wages, salaries, and prices in general had risen at the same pace. It was a bit inconvenient to work with the large numbers, but not overly difficult. Many people still spoke of it as a rise in prices. There were more exciting things to think about. But the mark now went on the rampage. Soon after the beginning of the Ruhr War, the dollar shot to 20,000 marks, rested there for a time, jumped to 40,000, paused again, and then, with small periodic fluctuations, coursed through the 10,000s and then the 100,000s. No one quite knew how it happened. Rubbing our eyes, we followed its progress like some astonishing natural phenomenon. It became the topic of the day. Then suddenly, looking around, we discovered that this phenomenon had devastated the fabric of our daily lives. Anyone who had savings in a bank, or bonds, saw their value disappear overnight. Soon it did not matter whether it was a penny put away for a rainy day or a vast fortune. Everything was obliterated. Many people quickly moved their investments, only to find that it made no difference. Very soon it became clear that something had happened that forced everyone to forget about their savings and attend to a far more urgent matter. The cost of living had begun to spiral out of control. Traders followed hard on the heels of the dollar. A pound of potatoes, which yesterday had cost 50,000 marks, now cost 100,000. The salary of 65,000 marks brought home the previous Friday was no longer sufficient to buy a packet of cigarettes on Tuesday. What was to be done? Casting around, people found a life raft. Shares. They were the only form of investment that kept pace. Not all the time, and not all shares, yet on the whole they managed to keep up. So everyone dealt in shares. Every minor official, every employee, every shift worker became a shareholder. Day-to-day purchases were paid for by selling shares. On wage days there was a general stampede to the banks, and share prices shot up like rockets. The banks were bloated with wealth. Obscure new ones sprouted up like mushrooms and did a roaring trade. Every day the entire population studied the stock market listings. Sometimes some shares collapsed and thousands of people hurtled toward the abyss. In every shop, every factory, every school, share tips were whispered in one's ear. The old and unworldly had the worst of it. Many were driven to begging, many to suicide. The young and quick-witted did well. Overnight they became free, rich, and independent. It was a situation in which mental inertia and reliance on past experience were punished by starvation and death, but rapid appraisal of new situations and speed of reaction were rewarded with sudden, vast riches. The 21-year-old bank director appeared on the scene, and also the high school senior who earned his living from the stock market tips of his slightly older friends. He wore Oscar Wilde ties, organized champagne parties, and supported his embarrassed father. Amid all the misery, despair, and poverty, there was an air of light-headed youthfulness, licentiousness, and carnival. Now, for once, the young had money, and the old did not. Moreover, its nature had changed. Its value lasted only a few hours. It was spent as never before or since, and not on the things old people spend their money on. Bars and nightclubs opened in large numbers. Young couples whirled about the streets of the amusement quarters. It was like a Hollywood movie. Everyone was hectically, feverishly searching for love and seizing it without a second thought. Indeed, even love had assumed an inflationary character.